reason that these Africans should not be getting the best of medical care at the hands of people who actually care about them, you know? And so that's the call, is people who might be interested in talking with Brother Yusuf about his health conditions. If you're a doctor, if you're a holistic practitioner and you have any expertise that can, you know, that can help this brother or any of the Africans who were a part of this experiment, then you can also contact me here and I can give you my personal contact information as well. Uhuru, this is Iyapo Ngina Bandele, and I am filling in this afternoon for the regular hosts of Solidarity Not Charity. Today, we are going to be playing a presentation made by the chairman, Omalia Shetela, on yesterday, on the yesterday convening of the African People Solidarity Conference. And that is, again, taking place today. That is why I'm filling in. So today we are going to be listening to a chairman made by a presentation made by the chairman of the African People's Socialist Party on yesterday. Uhuru.
I would like to express my deepest, most profound appreciation to the African People's Solidarity Committee for doing this conference and for being here. For existing, for making the commitment to take this incredibly significant work on. It cannot be overstated the significance of the existence of the African People's Solidarity Committee. That is, as compared to the Uhuru Solidarity Committee or any other kind of left and so-called progressive or, you know, force that's out there in the world. Because what has happened with folk who have made the commitment to unite with this struggle, to become a part of the African People's Solidarity Committee, is, as the slogan suggests, something that goes beyond a shallow recognition of the significance of charity for the unfortunate, as is often characterized. We won't have anything that approximates the approach to dealing with contradictions in the world that we see with an Angelina Jolie or Madonna going around, you know, kidnapping babies to rescue them from dire circumstances, which seem to simply befall on them from some mysterious place. It requires more than the great willingness of so many North Americans to jump on board the Obama bandwagon, which for many seemed to address the whole question of the relationship between black people and white people, and now perhaps everything has been resolved because there is finally a black president, which is the height, you know, of aspirations that anybody of quote-unquote color could have. It requires going beyond what is the obvious, what we can simply see. It is more than, what is this term where you accept as evidence those things that you can see? What is that called? Say? No.
It's empirical.
No. Okay.
Empirical.
Empirical. It's beyond empiricism. It's beyond empiricism. Because if we were trapped with a narrow kind of empiricism, you couldn't ever get to the recognition that the world is, in fact, some kind of sphere, you know, moving about in space. Because you look out and it looks flat. The world is flat. It's beyond empiricism. It's beyond what you can just see. I see it, therefore I believe it is real. And beyond this, I must have empirical evidence, immediate kind of evidence for everything. To do what forces in the APSC have done requires a recognition of the significance of scientific theory. And it is that kind of theory that would allow someone to recognize that beyond what is immediately obvious to us, There are other kinds of possibilities. Was it Galileo who they wanted to, and perhaps did, persecute in a very serious way because he says something, I think it was about the movement of the earth around the sun, as opposed to the sun around the earth. And I mean, if you walk out in the morning early enough, it appears that the sun is actually coming up from someplace in the earth, and in the evening it appears to be dropping down. And if we just go by what appears, what that kind of apparent thing, we don't understand anything. But that's where most people in the world are, because they do not have access to a scientific explanation and a way of understanding the world. If you have this way of understanding the world and phenomenon in general, then when someone with a telescope, and I know nothing about astronomy really, but can recognize that even though I can only see these objects in the universe, I know something else is there because of how it moves. And I understand some things about gravity and the gravitational pull that it would be necessary for a thing to move in the fashion that it moves. That's where African People Solidarity Committee is. It's that the reality is that we understand that African people are inferior, less civilized, and have all the contradictions that not only the worst of white nationalism teaches us, but the good friends, the liberals, who are ready to do charity, teach us the same thing. We know that. How do we know that's true? Because we see it. When we look out, we see poverty all around the African world. We see what has been told us is the corruption of African leaders everywhere. We see bloodshed and everything else. So there's that empirical data that teaches us that white people are indeed superior than everybody else, and that is the explanation for what it is that we're looking at. So we need something better than that. Otherwise, we'll be trapped in the same places. And if we do not have advantage of a scientific explanation for a phenomenon, that you can really use a scientific method to understand its existence. You can explain why this phenomenon occurs in the world. And if we don't have that, then we are doomed to the kind of short-sightedness and that you see in the world in general. Now, this task that we've come into, you see, people join African People Solidarity Committee for any number of reasons. People join it because y'all cool, you know. Y'all hang out with the black guys who play a lot of reggae and fila, you know. And also because y'all seem to be doing, you know, good charity work, helping good quote-unquote causes. People join for any kind of reasons, but the ones who stay for other reasons than that. And they stay, the ones who stay because they have united with their theory, with their philosophy. And they have united, and they are increasingly adept at utilizing the science themselves in understanding and explaining the world. That's the thing that gives us staying power. That's the thing that when people talk about, I used to be in the movement, but I got burnt out. What they mean is that they had no explanation. They could not be sustained beyond the hard parts, beyond the difficult parts, by a real understanding of what the hell was happening in the world. Because if they understood what was happening in the world, you don't get burned out. You get tired, you know. You get hurt. Your relationships get messed up. All kinds of things happen in the world, but you don't get burned out. Because you can be sustained by an understanding of what's happening, because things look bad right now. You know, I use the example sometimes, perhaps not even a good analogy, that you can have the flu. I've had the flu. I am a very bad flu haver. I suffer, you know, just in the worst kinds of ways. You know, I mean, I crawl on the floor, I moan, and et cetera, et cetera. I'm the worst person in the world to have flu. But the thing that keeps me from popping out the cyanide pill that I keep beneath my collar, right, and popping it in my mouth is that I know that the flu is going to be over in 7 days. 7 days hence, I'm going to be all right, right? And that is what it is about having the science. Because these rough periods that you go through, you know, you can be sustained through those periods, because that's what being burnt out means. When all your friends have now gone and joined Obama camp, or joined Jesse Jackson, that's what they were with before, and now they've joined the Obama camp. The thing that sustains you is because you have the advantage of the science. You understand what imperialism is, and understanding what imperialism is, you know that there is no way out of this thing except overturning the system itself. Mm-hmm. And that's what we have. Now, in some ways, a person comes into, at least stays in APSC, for reasons that are different from why an African joins the Uhuru movement or joins the party. Because an African comes into the movement and sometimes with a tremendous enthusiasm and radicalism because of what's happening in their lives, what's happening in his life, her life. Because somebody just got shot and they saw it. Because somebody just got killed. Because I live in this thing. Because everything about me, every place I go, I see all these limitations imposed on me because I'm an African. I'm pissed off. Mad most of the damn time. Pass a bus stop where Africans are standing. And unless it's Obama just got elected, right? Unless it's waiting for the inaugural thing right now. And you see the expressions on the faces of African people. Angry all the damn time. You know, and sometimes, I don't care, I don't have to hear this fucking theory. I know about what's happening, et cetera, et cetera. But they can't be sustained either without the theory. A lot of times, you know, like we have in this room now, people been in this movement 30 some odd years. Theory is what's kept them there. Africans come in often radical, upset, and if it were possible at the moment they come in to overturn the system, they're prepared to do it. And when the other shoe hits the floor, that's who's going to move this thing and turn it all around and turn it upside down. But Africans generally are in pain. It's pain. It's because Africans are in pain, generally speaking, that they come into the movement, except for sectors of the petty bourgeoisie that often joins the movement as well. And can be attracted by the theory of the movement because the theory of the movement recognizes certain kinds of limitations that impose on their circumstances, right? And they say the theory recognizes that, and so somehow and sometimes they're attracted to it because of that. In the 1960s, we had huge numbers of African people talking now. Essentially petty bourgeois folk, educated folk who joined the movements in Africa and here. And they joined it because of the limitations that they recognized that imperialism imposed on their lives. And they were incredible revolutionaries until the advent of, in this country, desegregation or civil rights bills and laws and things like that. And at that juncture, most of them left the broad masses of people exactly where they are. They became the forces similar to Barack Obama, and if not, they became some other kinds of nationalists who were able to be nationalists because, again, of the limitations imposed on them as African persons in a hostile white world. But even those folk, with the advent of a Barack Obama, have now discovered that what a great thing it is to have a black president, that this is a whole new day in our history, which is simply to say that the election of Barack Obama allowed for them to expose the deep patriotism that they have for America. Because Barack Obama didn't change imperialism, didn't change his nature or anything. It simply appeared to remove the barriers for the African petty bourgeoisie that impacted on their ability to succeed in America as black people. So now they say they love Barack Obama, that he should be. These are radicals. These are people who call themselves nationalists and talking about do for self and having your own black this and black that. But now they embrace American imperialism in the form of Barack Obama, and it shows that they are simply American patriots that have allowed to be so with this election throughout the continent of Africa in the 1960s, where you had a situation of colonialism, direct colonialism. Radicals emerged who became communists, became Maoists and Leninists and things like this, and actually led armed struggles against the Portuguese, against the South African government, and against other European colonial powers. And then, of course, once they got power, then what we came to understand is that their opposition to imperialism, their ability at the juncture that they were in the bush when they were making struggle to unite with communist philosophy, to unite, become Leninists and Maoists, etc., was because of the limitations imposed on the struggle by imperialism itself. Because all the imperialists were united with the Portuguese, and all the imperialists were united with the South African regime, and all the imperialists were united with other forces of colonialism, which meant the only support that this sect of the African petty bourgeoisie could get was from Russia, who had its own beef with the U.S. and European imperialism, looking out for its own interests. China, who had its beef not only with U.S. and European imperialism, but also with Russia. And so as a way forward, they became Maoists, they became Leninists, they got AK-47s, they got training, they got support that allowed them to engage in struggle, but at the juncture the struggle was over, all of that Mao, all of that Lenin, all of that quote-unquote Pan-Africanism was thrown out the window. The masses continued to suffer. You see, and a similar thing has happened here. And so we have Africans, the petty bourgeoisie, who will join the party, join the Uhuru movement, radical as hell. But what motivates them is the thing that all classes, conscious of their own interests, sees their interests as the interests of the whole people. So when they talk about black people, they're talking about black people like themselves, with the same class interests, with the same location in the world. That's what they're talking about. And that's a natural thing that human beings do, by the way. That's what white people have no problem saying, what is civilized? Civilized is the way we are. And all classes have this tendency of doing that. In fact, the problem is that too often the African working classes are not conscious of its own interest. It's too busy struggling with this stuff. It's not like the African petty bourgeoisie that has time, that goes to school, that can have the advantage of learning how to tussle with theoretical questions and things like that. They're just struggling from day to day up against the wall. They're thrown belly first on the floors of subways and shot in the back. They're shot twice in the back out of a graduation party in what is characterized as some ghetto in the worst parts of the African community. That's what ordinary folk have done. That's what pisses them off all the time and keep them ready to struggle. But that's also what, generally speaking, keeps them from having access to revolutionary theory. So, when the word is given, there's no doubt in my mind, even in this city, right now, if the word is given, the mass of African workers, particularly young folk,
Right now, at this moment,
walk out the street, we can see it happen, that they will take off on a project to fight the police, to fight evidence of the state. We need them at other times, but that's what we can see. And so even when it comes to our movement, we see like some folk will come, Africans, come into the party, come into the movement, raring to go, as they say in the old Western movies. And a lot of enthusiasm, a lot of energy, and sometimes they don't last. They have no staying power because it has not been theory as such that they've been won to. But on the other hand, North Americans who join and stay with APSC, join and stay not because they're in that kind of pain, but because they have come to unite with the theory. That's what makes who you are and what you do so significant. See, if you stay, it's because you've been won to the science, been won to the theory, which is not to say that it's a smooth road thereafter, because we know about the rocky roads that we travel, every one of us. I'm not just talking about as an organization, we have principles and processes and procedures that will identify problems in the organization that might be anybody in the room. And therefore, the organization has to respond to that particular problem. I'm not talking about whether or not we have these kinds of contradictions, because we do. And in fact, I appreciate one of the most important things Mao Zedong, who was chairman of the Chinese Communist Party. One of the things I appreciate most is he talked about one of the most difficult struggles is the struggle with self. Is the struggle with self. And of course, part of that, most of what that's about is the fact that, you know, we are the center of the universe. Who was it? Galileo has not yet visited us. And our world is the most important world. Every contradiction we have as individuals, that's the contradiction. What's this other stuff? That's the contradiction, the one I suffer from. And what it means is that too often, we are oblivious to the fact that what is happening is there is, in fact, something that you cannot see. There's another object that's out there that's responsible for the way that planet moves. We know it's there because of how it acts, and part of that, you know, it helps us to understand what part of our understanding is, that there are a whole bunch of contradictions in the world. And part of the contradiction in the world is us as individuals, you know, but there is such a thing as a main contradiction, a fundamental contradiction. It is the contradiction around which all the others revolve. It is the contradiction without which the others could not exist. But the problem is that too often we spend time dealing with those other contradictions and allowing the main contradictions to exist. Penny is very much into alternative kind of health stuff. I appreciate that. The reason I mention that is because allopathic medicine, as you know, everybody in this room knows, it's not about wellness. It's about sickness. So if something is wrong with anybody here, you go to the approach of medicine as they characterize it here, is that kill the evidence that something being wrong. Right? Got a headache? Cut off the head. No. I got a headache. You know, hit you on the hammer, toe with a hammer, and you'll forget about it. But the thing is that, you know, it's always symptoms that's dealt with, not the main contradiction, not the primary contradiction, because if you have a headache, it means that something is wrong somewhere, doesn't it? Yeah. The headache is simply a symptom of a problem that you've got, isn't it? I mean, that's the reality. So just to do something that takes away the symptom is not to deal with the contradiction, and that's That's what we understand, is we are about more than simply symptoms. We are about getting to the essence of this thing. Hamas and the attack on Gaza is a symptom of a deep and profound contradiction. And you can run around forever dealing with those symptoms, and because it doesn't matter, as long as the beast lives. As long as the beast lives, the symptoms are going to be here, there, and other places. Headache this time, tomorrow is some other problem that you're going to have, because the beast continues to exist, right? So our movement, for a long period of time, has been engaged in struggle to deal with the response that people have to these symptoms. So that, because it's much easier to engage somebody in a discussion about the flu. I mean, you're going to talk to somebody about the flu, they don't have no symptoms, they've never had it, the cousins don't have it, etc. It's much harder for them to have an interest in the flu, right? But it's much easier to deal with somebody who's got the flu to talk about how to get to it. So we'll work with that person who has a symptom. We'll work with it. We'll grab that person who has a symptom, particularly if it's a popular symptom. Particularly if it's something that most of the people around us sooner or later are going to have that symptom anyway. We'll work with them, and we'll try to help them understand, even as we take on the symptom of this problem, we'll try to help them to understand where the origin of this thing is, because you're going to have it again. Of course, the real problem is that even when people have heart attacks, you know, and they swear when they have a heart attack and they go to the medic and the medic tells them, you got to stop how you eat. You're going to have to start exercising. They swear that they're going to do it until they feel better. You know, isn't it? And then they feel better. All that advice is out the window, generally speaking. And that happens, too, in our movement. It happens, too. And until, of course, such a crisis occurs that that we can take advantage of and lock this lesson in a fashion that helps to escalate the crisis, and then, you know, sweep us forward under the leadership of the party. And so that's what we've been about. The 1960s was, as I mentioned earlier, was the last outstanding era in the world. The last outstanding era in the world where the crisis of imperialism represented it, was responded to and also caused by. In many ways, the conscious activity of peoples around the world. Chinese Revolution, Vietnamese Revolution, Cuban Revolution, struggles throughout Latin America, Africa, etc. People in this country, and particularly African Revolution, these were the things that were pushing history forward. It's just an incredible period of time. And the problem was that imperialism initiated a counter-offensive against the revolutionary process. Not just here. It was obvious here. They killed Fred Hampton. They murdered Bobby Hutton. They murdered all kinds of people. They murdered Che Guevara in Bolivia. I say murder as opposed to having killed. Because, you know, they captured Che. You know that, don't you? Yeah. And they had him tied up in a hut. And they came in and executed him. They murdered Che Guevara. It wasn't like he was killed in war or anything like that. And so we saw this whole struggle to put down revolutionaries, what they did to the people of Nicaragua, to crush that struggle, what they did in El Salvador, you know, to make sure that the people could not be free. And have no doubt about it, it was an attempt to, it wasn't even about the freedom of the people. It's not. That's one mistake that we make when we think about imperialism. Imperialism is not about keeping people unfree. What imperialism is about is extracting all your resources and all your value, and it will do any goddamn thing necessary to do it. So it's not like, well, let's go over and keep some people unfree. It's about execute, wipe out, destroy anything that prevents us from taking what we need. That's what imperialism is about. And so a serious counter-offensive
That's why they cannot see the dead babies, you know, and the other kinds of things that happen to us. That's why even now, we talked about the people cheering to watch murder. That's what it's about. And it's a mass consciousness in the European communities to do that. Sometimes not to see it, but to do it. And so counteroffensive was initiated. Quarantine Cuba. Starve it. Don't allow it to be the kind of example of the possibilities of the people once free from imperialism, of poor people, oppressed people, to have a different kind of future. Don't allow that to occur. Don't allow the Cuban example to be something that can inflame the passions and aspirations of oppressed people like them around the world. Quarantine, starve them. Keep them from being able to do anything there. And then hold them up as examples of the failures of poor people. Once you're poor and you try to go on your own, this is what happens to you. Use Zimbabwe. Use all over Africa. Why would, look at, when the white man was here, you were much better off. And the whole world recognizes that black people were much better off when white people controlled everything. And so, like the whole revolutionary movement, essentially, most of it was wiped out. And there cannot be, regardless of what anybody has ever suggested, some successful socialism in isolation. Can happen. You got a world economy, and that's been the reality for a very long time. So you can't have this one little spot here that's isolated, that's separated from the economy of the rest of the world, that's going to be this wonderful place. And so they starve and say, see, it doesn't work. It doesn't work. And we're going to be saying that, see, it doesn't work. A lot in the next few ourselves. So we've been involved in this struggle. And it's been a rocky road. Because some people, you know, through movies and idealists have come to understand revolution to be this easy path, this romantic thing. You get your beret and you wear it in a cocky fashion, right? And, you just march forward, you know, it's this, but it's a difficult thing. And the revolutionary is not someone who simply AK-47 and engaged in armed struggle. The revolutionary has the responsibility of solving the problems of the revolution. That's what we are confronted with right now. And looking at what are the problems of the revolution and solving those problems so that we can move forward and contribute to what I believe is the critical mass that's being approached now in terms of this struggle against imperialism. And a fundamental thing that we are looking at is the role of the masses in this question. The informed role of the masses. And the reality, we recognize that this will not happen, this will not occur by happenstance. That it will require revolutionary leadership in the form of a revolutionary party guided by revolutionary philosophy. And that is able to recognize other kind of phenomenon that's necessary for revolution to occur in the world. We know what some of those are. We know that revolution requires a crisis, doesn't it? And we've been swimming in this crisis for some time, and it's getting deeper and deeper every day. And we know that revolution requires people having come to the conclusion that anything is better than this stuff that we're living in today. And revolution requires the inability of the ruling class to rule in the same old way. Those are some of the things that revolution requires. We see the crisis, and we have seen glimpses of people being able to say that anything is better. All over Africa, you see, I'm telling you, all over Africa now, the situation is so ripe in terms of people being ready to take it on because they are ready to face death in the face of the circumstances that they are confronted with now. Ruling class can't rule in the same way. Yes and no inside this country. Yes and no inside this country. They still have the two-party Republican, I should say, the, I don't know how, some people call it a duopoly. They still have this, you know, Republican Party, Democratic Party a farce as contenders, this farcial contention for control of the state through the electoral process. That's evidence of ruling in the same way. But it's necessary to put a Negro at the helm, which is evidence of an inability to rule in the same old way, right? And the willingness of the people to struggle. I think momentarily we can see has been muted with the election of Barack Obama, which seems to show evidence that things can be all right. But I'm telling you, that is shallow. And not only is it shallow, but despite all of what the evidence that we see, we were just discussing how many people are going to go to this this coronation that happens, you know, on the 20th of this month. And they're saying it won't be as many because of the economy, et cetera. And I'm suggesting probably going to be a whole bunch of Africans who want to go, et cetera. Despite that, first of all, that's not going to be long-lasting. But secondly, there's a whole bunch of people who don't give a damn. I'm talking about Africans. I was reading an interesting thing. This is from a kind of conservative book, magazine, called Africa Today, Voice of the Continent. And on the front cover, world-exclusive interviews, Obama is not Reverend King's dream. Now listen. Richard Williams, free spirit and father of Venus and Serena, and estranged wife, Orsine Price, speaks out. This is what Richard Williams says. This is what Richard Williams said. He says, they're asking the question, okay, what is this thing about you and gold and diamonds in Africa we hear? He says, this is not very new. My thing is that I would like to buy a lot of gold and diamonds from Africa, and I would like them to have 99.99% purity, so that we can sell them to our buyers in the West. We then use the money to pursue a great educational program in Africa. And the starting program, if the people of Africa can be patient with me and allow the program to grow and do not want me to produce a champion right away, we can turn out tennis pros. We need time to do that. So why do you want to do this? He's talking about a lot of things. He says, altruism or profit-making. He said, why would you say altruistic or money-making? You journalists always turn on cynical and sarcastic when you hear a good plan about Africa from over here. I have always been involved with Africa in one project or the other. I am an African and would remain an African. I am not an Afro-American or African-American. Those are fancy words. It just happens that I was born in the United States, but that don't make any difference to me or who I am. They ask him, now let us talk about another African of African parentage. Are you excited and rooting for the new great hope, the savior of democratic virtues, democratic presidential nominee, Senator Barack Obama? He says, why should I talk about somebody that does not see himself as one of us? He means nothing to me. I have nothing to say to Obama. The preacher, Reverend Jeremiah Wright, tried talking to him. He cut him off. The preacher was telling the truth about how America treats us blacks as slaves and how Obama is sucking up to the white folks because he wants to be president. Why would anyone be excited about this man who has simply lost it and is letting himself be used as a token? This man talks down to black people. He's afraid to address issues directly affecting black people and growing racism in America. I will never root for him or vote. They question, despite America's diminished stature, the U.S. president remains the most powerful man in the world, able to, like no other, to make decisions on global consequences. Is Obama's success not the dream Reverend Martin Luther King was talking about? Are you not surprised? Hell no, I'm not surprised. Certainly not. It's downright annoying when you mention him in the same sentence as Reverend King. This is not the dream Reverend King was talking about. Blacks are not free in America. Obama's not following in Reverend King's path. If for one second you think that Obama is that dream, this great hope, as you put it, then you are, you and your lot are very much mistaken. So, I mean, this is, you know, Richard Williams, you understand? This is, he's more radical than the whole reparations movement and the whole, you know, the people who have been debating the question of Obama all around the country. He is no politician. He's no revolutionary. He's, I don't even know how progressive he is, but he's up on this question. So I'm telling you that this thing, this Barack Obama thing, it appears all of that right now. It's temporary, and what you see also, I want to say, is not all that there is there. Yes. And so it's deep and very profound, and even many of the Africans who believe in Obama believe in him because we have not had access to them, because we have not had an opportunity to have a discussion with them. I'm not talking about the petty bourgeoisie. I'm talking about people I run into in the barbershop. Who just a simple, just brief discussion say, I knew something was wrong with him. You know, it doesn't take much, you know what I mean? So we haven't had access to them. And these are not people who are gonna go there, and they're gonna feel warm and have good feelings temporarily when Obama goes in the inauguration, because they're not gonna let you not see that inauguration. They're not going to let you not see. I mean, there's no way in hell you're going to be able to get away from that inauguration. It's going to be on everything. Mm-hmm. I went to the doctor to deal with pneumonia. And my doctor says something to me that on the 20th, I'm changing all my appointments. I'm not taking any points from this and this and this. Said, are you going to Washington, D.C.? I can't believe it. I don't think so. But here's the point that I want to make. Is that it's a rocky road. It's not a smooth road. And if that's what you're looking for, you're in the wrong damn place, because life ain't like that. The world ain't like that. The struggle ain't like that. That's right. And there's nobody in this room who at one juncture or another has not had our asses kicked. Right. You know, in the movement, in the struggle. You know, because it's not a simple process. And because, you know, we all have bad habits. We've all been trained by imperialism. Our appetites have been defined and whetted by imperialism. Our desires, aspirations, defined and whetted by imperialism. And if not directly, and then indirectly, it's pushed us in directions that don't satisfy what our real interests and objectives are. But the point that we make is this. Not that we are errorless. Not that, and guess what? We made big old mistakes. We don't make tiny mistakes, because we don't do tiny things. Most of our projects are profoundly significant. And so we have the ability, and we do make big mistakes. But the thing that I'm talking about is this, that our trajectory is a revolutionary trajectory. Our trajectory, the one that we consciously put ourselves on, is one that's designed to overturn this entire relationship that we have with imperialism. So in the process of doing that, we make errors. But we have some glorious successes as well in the process of doing that. And it's a rocky road, because we make mistakes in the process of doing that. And I think it's important to acknowledge that and to say, don't think that we don't as an organization or that you won't as an individual. And as an organization, when we do it, if we are at our best, we'll make a self-criticism and say we made this error, because it's important to us to acknowledge our errors and then to use these errors to teach others and to teach our movement so that we don't do it again. And if you make the errors, we're going to say that you made the error. We're going to criticize you like hell. Not because we don't like you, not because the one doing the criticizing doesn't have to make errors ourselves, but because we want to make the movement better, make everybody better, make the organization more capable. That's the basis of criticism and self-criticism in our movement, right? So that's what it's about. And I'm saying this because, you know, we come into the movement, you know, like from a place of blaming and avoiding blame. That's what the whole thing, blaming and avoiding blame. And that's not what criticism and self-criticism is about, which is not to say that there are not those in our movement who have used it in that fashion, who've used it, and sometimes people who've been criticized, we've had people who get engaged in what we call guerrilla warfare. You criticize them, right? It may be 3 years later, but they ain't in the cut. They're waiting for you, buddy. They've got you on the list, on the calendar, you know, in the computer, right? And at the moment you make this criticism, boy, there, this error, there it is, boom. So they use it like a weapon, right? And then there are those who use self-criticism to deflect criticism. Right? And as opposed to taking a self-criticism to try to explain and deepen and show how the contradiction, the source of it, to move us forward, they would take a... There are people in our movement who have become actual experts at self-criticism, which is something, which means they got a lot of practice messing up, obviously. And what they do is they use self-criticism and they bleed all over you. You know, I mean, by the time you leave the place, they've bled so much all over the place, you know, you up to your ankles in blood, you know, by the time you have this self-criticism. And they use this to deflect, oh, yes, I did it. I'm the worst person in the world. And then there are people who use self-criticism like some of us use words like love, and the most annoying thing is, for me, and please, is white people who step on your foot or do something, and sorry, you know what I mean? Oh, that's the most annoying thing. It just ruin your day, ruin your life, right? Sorry, you know, and that's sometimes self-critical, I'm self-critical, you know, and it makes me want to shoot somebody. I hate this word. I want to hear self-criticism every more in my life, you know? But, so some people will misuse it. But that's not a statement about its value because people misuse it, right? And so we do that. And so we right now, obviously, it's a critical time in history. The thing that we see with this man, Obama and imperialism and how imperialism is trying to move now, I was looking at this this magazine that you know, you got a chance, maybe you could look at it every now and then. It's called Foreign Policy. It's a bourgeois publication. They put it out to explain to these thinking representatives of the bourgeoisie, explain the phenomena, explain the world, etc. And here you can see the front. Yes, he did, but what if he can't? Yes, but on the top of the page, five economists who got it right predict the worst is yet to come. And that is, in fact, the way it is. I mean, it is going to get extremely, extremely bad. And that is a part of the crises, and it says something about our task, our mission right now. Because this is the time that we're supposed to win. You know, people make the comparison of Barack Obama and Franklin Delano Roosevelt, yeah, which I think is a good comparison. But the thing about Roosevelt is Roosevelt's program was counter-revolutionary program. And many historians say that today, and I think even said it then, that Roosevelt's programs, these Bill of Rights and WPAs and all this other kind of stuff, Social Security, was stuff that was done to keep revolution from happening in this country. And some of them were extraordinarily clear about that. That they put those kinds of programs. It became substitutes for real solutions that people needed to change their circumstances. And of course, they were helped. He was helped, you know, by the Communist Party USA and what have you, accelerated developing these programs. But they were substitutes. But the other thing that I would mention to you, and Barack Obama is a substitute for revolution, first, and now this stuff that he's talking about, these programs are substitutes. These wonderful programs he's talking about, that's going to cost more than $1 trillion that he's talking about, and I say much, much more, because I think it's done something like 30, what, how many trillion have they done up to now? 7 trillion up to now, 8.5 trillion up to now. But the thing is that what they don't say is that Roosevelt, even after, in 1938, after he had been in office for 6 years, the unemployment rate in this country was 20%. Wow. That's the official unemployment rate. After he had been there for 6 years, in 1938, the unemployment rate in this country was 20%. And the unemployment rate in this country, the unemployment has not even begun to go up the way it's going to go up. So this is real crisis. And I say, and you figure in 1938, how much of the African population was even factored right. as a part of the labor force? You know, even when I think when they kicked off, was it Social Security?
Yes.
You know, people who, most Africans it was not available for us. If you were house servants, if you did a certain kind of labor in this country, you didn't get Social Security. How's that?
Farm workers
were not covered. So think about all the Africans. Think about the numbers of Africans who were locked down in chain gangs in 1938, who were engaged in convict leasing in 1938. You know, so that doesn't even begin to address the real unemployment when you talk about the 20% even. But that's serious. And the other thing is that, of course, the war is what really brought this country and the imperialists out of the Depression. Of course, you know Germany's response to the economic crisis. You know. And all of them had colonial responses of some sort or another. And so our task right now, and it's a critical juncture, and I believe that we're in some ways in a better place than we've been in a long time, is to build organization. Build organization. I think our theory has been something that's been influenced. We've seen the influence of our theory in so many places around the world, here in this country, even though it's not acknowledged as our theory, but that we've created a whole different way of seeing the world and thinking about things, even that allows bourgeois theorists and economists to now talk about some of these questions about the parasitism that is the basis for U.S. and Western imperialism. So we've done that effectively, I really believe. But I think now that the real demand is not to say that we have done what needs to be done, because so much needs to be done, especially as we talked about earlier, of taking theory to the masses. I talked about, you know, being able to talk to somebody about the flu once they have the flu. What we have to do in terms of an analogy is to be able to forge revolutionary theory, science, into the mass struggle that people increasingly will find themselves involved in. In Oakland, St. Petersburg, other places around the world. Because the people don't need us just to lead a damn demonstration. They can do that by themselves. They don't need somebody to teach them a new chant, right? What they need is revolutionary science, theory. That's what we have to be able to do. Beyond that, we need to build organization in the most effective way, in the most effective way, better than what we've ever done before. That's the struggle that we're involved in as a party right now, to try to build organization and to build our presence in concrete ways around the world that represent our theory, represent our programmatic thrust. Some of you, you know, are familiar with the ASI, the African Socialist International work that we've been doing, and that has been a serious struggle. The APDEP work as a part of the ASI venture. Comrade Aisha, who has been to Sierra Leone and has sent people to Sierra Leone and sent resources to Zimbabwe and people to Zimbabwe. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that's what we're involved in right now. We are doing this. Nobody else is doing this. We are doing this. I mean, some people are sending people places and creating charity programs in places, but not programs that's designed to overturn the relationship, and not that we have an imperialism, and not programs designed to unite the African nation around the world. So we're doing that. In October, I think it was, we just had a successful conference how many days? 4 or 5 day conference in Sierra Leone, and having from 550 to 600 people a day. It was a remarkable conference that things I read saying that nothing like this has happened in West Africa since the 1930s, where socialists, revolutionary socialists, came together to talk about a program for advancing the revolutionary process. It's really interesting in terms of the influence of the party. This is a December issue of African Business. Just a little thing on page 9, under a kicker conference, it reads, African socialists call for slavery reparations. African socialists have issued a new call for reparations to be paid to Africans for 400 years of slavery. Delegates at the first West African conference of the African Socialist International in Freetown, Sierra Leone, insisted that it is long overdue for the West to pay for the heinous crimes committed against Africans for our enslavement and dehumanization, unquote. Heading the call was Ismael Rashid, a Sierra Leonean professor of African history at New York's Vassar College. Rashid maintains that asking for reparations is no favor demanded from the West. It is our right because through slavery, the West stole our labor, dignity, and resources. It is repayment for our labor, our looted human resources, unquote. He invited reparations both in the forms of technology transfer and financial resources, quote, because slavery destroyed Africa's early potential for growth and industrial advancement, unquote. The conference brought together African socialists from throughout the continent, Europe, and the United States to discuss slavery and other themes. This article was cut because the last thing here says, the African People's Socialist Party was founded in the U.S. in the U.S. in the 1970s as a product of the Black Power movement. So this is the African business. This is not just the African, this is African business. And so, this is something that's happening in Africans all around the world are reading this and aware of this. And then the Africans who were there are being impacted by that. And in March, there's going to be an ASI conference in East Africa, in Nairobi, Kenya, where Africans from all over East Africa will be coming. In March, there's also another conference that's going to be happening, a major conference in West Africa, in Sierra Leone, and where the objective is to mobilize, we're mobilizing like hell to bring Africans into the African Socialist International. In May, in Washington, D.C., the North American African Socialist International Conference will be happening through the African Liberation Day project that we have, where Africans from Canada and from the United States will be coming together to consolidate a North American region of the African Socialist International. In July, either in Zimbabwe or South Africa, and possibly in Zimbabwe, we'll be having the Southern African ASI conference to build a regional ASI committee there, and to establish the ASI. Right now, there are ASI forces in Zimbabwe, in South Africa, in, what's the other place with the LLNC?
Swaziland.
Swaziland, you know? So, I mean, that's the work that's happening now. This is a really dynamic and critical time in history. Even as we are going to Swaziland, even as we're going to Southern Africa, the ANC is imploding on itself. The crisis there is deepening every day. September, I think it is, of this year, we'll be having a World Tribunal of Africans and for Africa and African reparations in South Africa, in Pretoria.